You're listening to Talking Baseball with Ed Randall, presented by MLB.com. He's Ed Randall. He's talking baseball. What more do you need?
Hi, everybody. I'm Ed Randall, Big Ed and Nora's baby boy, and welcome back to Ed Randall's Talking Baseball. From time to time, or intermittently, there's a 50-cent word for you, around this joint, we're going to highlight the iconic broadcast voices of the game. We begin with the great radio play-by-play man of the Cincinnati Reds, who has been hanging around since 1974 and was inducted into the broadcast wing of the Hall of Fame in 2000. And this game is underway. That's what he says. When you sign your checks and things, do you sign HOF at the end, Marty Brenneman?
I do not, Ed. The funny thing about that is that when you're inducted, they ask you that at least for the next year, every time you sign an autograph, you sign HOF. And the year you go in. And I told him, I said, you know what, that's a little bit presumptuous. I said, if a fan asks me to do it, I'll do it, but I am not going to automatically do that unless they request it. And, you know, after a while, they ask you to do that, especially if you're signing a ball in the sweet spot. Would you put HOF 2000? And I'm more than happy to. But like I told him in Cooperstown, I said, I'm not going to presume that this is important enough that they need me to put that on there unless they ask me. So, I mean, it's the way it is.
What an honor, though. Do you go back to the Hall of Fame much?
You know what? I'm embarrassed to say I've been back one time, and that was not even on induction weekend. I was up there in November. A good friend of mine and a great friend of the Hall of Fame, Bob Crotty, who has a tremendous museum of his own that he built in Cincinnati, a baseball memorabilia, and has contributed heavily to the National Baseball Hall of Fame, took me and my wife up for a weekend a number of years ago, and it was a special weekend because we spent it with Harmon Killebrew, and I'd known him for years, but not well, and my wife and I spent a lot of time with him, and then, of course, we all know he passed away a number of years ago, one of the truly great people in the history of baseball.
Yes, he was.
But that's the only time I've been back. Only time.
When you were a kid at the University of North Carolina in the 60s, are you thinking about a life that has turned out to be the way it turned out?
I don't think you can ever think about that. I went to a small boys' school in Virginia, Randolph-Macon College, and transferred to Chapel Hill because I couldn't get into Carolina as an out-of-state student when I got out of high school in Virginia. And so I knew I wanted to be in the field of communications, and further than that, I knew I wanted to be a play-by-play guy. I knew I did not want to be a 6 and 11 o'clock TV sports studio guy.
Which was your first job out of Carolina.
Exactly. I worked at a television station, High Point, North Carolina, because I couldn't find a radio job, and then I got hired.
WSTP.
A 1,000-watt radio station in Salisbury, which was the greatest thing that ever happened to me because I did high school and Catawba College football and basketball. I did American Legion baseball, and that part of the country is a hotbed for Legion baseball. They play upwards of 50 or 55 games, which is almost the equivalent of a rookie league schedule.
And to come out of North Carolina and make $100,000 for doing all those things immediately.
Yeah, that's quite, I'll never
move
forget.
Move the decimal point about three decimals over.
The first job I had, and this was in television, and I didn't make a whole hell of a lot more when I moved from High Point in television to Salisbury in radio. I was married and had two kids, and I was making $105 a week in 1965. But I knew I wanted to be a play-by-play guy. I worked in the American Basketball Association with the old Virginia Squires.
4 years.
Yep, and was there with Charlie Scott, Julius Erving, and George Gervin. Did AAA baseball for Dave Rosenfield in Norfolk with the Tides when they were the Mets AAA club. Never dreamed I'd be a big league baseball broadcaster. I was so enamored with basketball, and Dave recommended me to Dick Wagner at the winter meetings in November of 73 because Al Michaels had left.
To go to the Giants.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And Dave said, I got a guy who does my games, and I think he does a pretty good job. And Dick Wagner said, tell him to send me a tape, which I did. A long story short.
So did 200 others.
Yeah, that's right. 221 people, I think, applied for the job. But I did it more as a favor to Dave because Dave thought enough of my work, and God bless him, he's still there in Norfolk today.
Is.
He was so good to me and had so much faith in my ability, more so than I did. I was doing baseball because they needed to find something for me to do in the summertime.
Was basketball number one in your heart then,
at that time?
Because it's funny when you say, you know, I'm in AAA and I'm not thinking about the major leagues. Everybody's in AAA is thinking about going to the major league.
I really wasn't. I didn't even know whether I was good enough to be a big league baseball announcer, but I felt like I was good enough. If the merger ever came, then I could get a job in the NBA because I thought I was a good enough basketball announcer. And then, you know, when Dave recommends me for the job, and we had a writer in the Norfolk Virginian Pilot named George McClellan, and he covered hockey as well as baseball, and he'd periodically come into Cincinnati because they were in the same hockey league, Cincinnati Swords and the team in Norfolk, and he had feelers out, and he knew people. He'd come back and say, well, they've cut the list down to 50, and you're still one of the in there, and I took it with a grain of salt until he came back one time and said, they've reduced the list to 10, and you're one of them. And at that point, I decided, you know what? I might want this job.
And you went to Cincinnati.
They call me. They call me on the phone one day and say, we want to come. We want to bring you to Cincinnati. And they'd reduce the list to 3. And I had to do a basketball game in Indianapolis, the Squires and the Pacers, on a Saturday night. I flew into Cincinnati on Thursday night, had dinner with them, Dick Wagner and a couple of other people. And then they introduced me to Mr. Housen on Friday. Mm-hmm. They brought me to the ballpark, and we interviewed extensively. And they said, we're going to take you back to the hotel, and I know you've got a flight to catch Indianapolis, which is a short flight, and we'll give you a call. And so I go back to the hotel, and 30 minutes after I get there, I'm packing to leave. They call me. They say, we've decided we're going to offer you the job and want to bring you back to the ballpark. And so I went back, and they laid the thing out. They were going to pay me $30,000 the first year. Yeah, three-year deal, 30 grand.
Three-year
deal.
Did you ever had a multi-year deal ever?
No, but it was a three-year deal with an option, club option after the first year.
Oh, there you go.
Yeah, okay. Thank you.
We got an out.
That's right.
It's an opt-out.
30 grand the first year, 35 and 35. And so they lay it out for me, and I said, I'll let you know.
Really?
And they said, what? I said, I don't.
You're just beating out 221 guys.
Yeah, I don't move unless I make sure it's okay with my wife. And I said, I'm going to go home Sunday morning. I'll talk to her. We were living at Virginia Beach. And they said, it was kind of funny then because they took a complete about face. Well, could you call us when you have a decision? I said, sure. So I go home and we talk and we agreed this is the best move for me and called him back at 5 o'clock that Sunday afternoon and said yes and then reported for the job on February 1st, 1974.
And your first game that season you call it brutal, but it was historic.
It was. They were playing the Atlanta Braves, and opening day in Cincinnati is a big deal. Unlike any other opening day in baseball, it's a big
parade.
Deal. Kids get off of school if they have a ticket. Sure. They have the Finley Market Parade. And what added to it was the fact that Henry Aaron is sitting on 713 home runs. And there was some conversation about whether or not he was definitely playing game one. And the commissioner made it known he's got to play.
Right.
He's got to play the first game. Well, first inning, they get two men on base, and Jack Billingham's pitching, and he fell behind 3-1. And the next pitch, Henry lined over the left field wall to tie Babe Ruth's home run record.
And your first inning in the major leagues.
First half inning. And the inning finally ends, and, of course, the guy that I grew to work with over 31 years and love like a brother, Joe Nuxhall, he said, I'll be damned. He said, what in the hell do you do for an encore? I said, I don't know. It was kind of cool. Still had the tape. Felt like the call was not bad for a kid that was floating on cloud 9 with 55,000 people in the ballpark. I'd never seen that before. And the Reds won the game. Interestingly enough, they win the game in extra innings. Tony Perez had a home run off Phil Niekro. They brought him into relief in the 8th inning. Perez had a home run to tie it. And then they win it in extra innings when Pete scored from second base on a Buzz Capra wild pitch.
Wow.
I mean, it was unbelievable. And I'm off and running at that point.
Your voice is enshrined on that. Your voice is enshrined on a base hit to left field by Pete Rose. Carmelo Martinez of the Padres jumps up and catches the ball. And I can't imagine what that must be like, as that will be played for us and for generations to come for as long as baseball is played.
Well, you know, and I know you can appreciate this with all the years you've been around and talking to guys like me. There are guys that plan what they're going to say. I never felt like I was good enough to keep it from sounding contrived if I tried to plan.
So good for you.
The only thing you can do is hope that what comes out flows and there's no stuttering and stammering. And I felt like, you know, when Pete got the hit, I felt like it came out pretty well. And because you know that you're going to hear it ad nauseum as long as you live and as long as your kids live and their kids. And so I felt like it came out pretty well, and I was happy with it. And more important than that, I think Pete was happy with it. And he's a dear friend of mine today, as he's been throughout the years.
You come up, and the first game, Hank Aaron ties Babe Ruth. The baseball team in 75 wins the World Series in an unforgettable World Series against the Red Sox. Sweep the Yankees back-to-back championships in 76. Now it's the 80s, and the franchise is going sideways, and Vin Scully gives you great advice. Mm-hmm. The 82 club, for example, lost 101 games.
Right.
I broadcast 7 years in the minor leagues. This is not to insert myself in the conversation, but I worked for good teams and bad teams,
exactly.
And oh my goodness. But Scully gave you great advice.
Yeah, I asked him one day, and Vinny's been like a mentor to me. Even though I'm 73 years old, I mean, you're talking about the greatest play-by-play guy in the history of the game. And I respect that, and I know that. And there have been times when I've asked him for his advice, and I asked him one day because I'd never been a part of a losing team. You know, from 74 until that never-to-be-forgotten 101-loss season, and 2 or 3 years before that, I asked him one day, I said, Vinny, what is it like to broadcast for a bad team, a losing team? He said, well, hopefully you'll never have to experience it, but if you hang around long enough, you will. And he said, you have to take every game as a season unto itself. You can't say, if the Reds win tonight, this is when the Reds and the Dodgers win the same division, and the Reds win tonight, the Dodgers lose, the Reds are 16 and a half games out of first place. They pick up a game because it's irrelevant now. But as bad as a team might be, you're going to have two or three guys that are having pretty good years. And so you accentuate whatever positives you have. He said, I'm not saying to you that you have to be a homer and you have to gloss over a bad team, but you really have to make an adjustment because it's a team that's not going to be in the race. It's a team that's going to be hopelessly out of it relatively early, and you have to make do with what you've got. I couldn't relate to that until I experienced it, and I think all of us come out of it being a better broadcaster for having experienced a bad year.
I was just going to say that.
Yeah, because you have to work hard. Today, and I joke all the time, I said, I've got to do my best Fred Astaire impersonation. I've got to tap dance a lot. And we talk about other things other than baseball. And it's the way it is. I mean, people come up to me and say, boy, I really feel sorry for you about this 2016 season. And I say, don't feel bad about me. I said, I've got 3 world championship rings. I've been a part of great teams with great players, and I've been able to do what I love for now 43 years. I said, so don't feel bad about me. I said, because I can get through it. I've been around long enough to know how to deal with this type of situation.
Having gone through so much with Pete Rose, mm-hmm. What did it do to you personally?
Well, it killed me. You know, so many things that happened, like when Sparky was fired. I broke down and cried. I was still relatively...
Sparky new. Told me that he went to a meeting at a hotel at LAX to meet Dick Wagner for what he thought was going to be his return the following season.
Right.
And then he was fired. And he said to me, I'll never forget this. You talk about putting life in perspective. He said, I got back in the car. And, of course, I was devastated, but then I turn on the radio, and that's the day that Mayor Moscone was killed in office in City Hall in San Francisco. Unbelievable. And he said that really put it into context. But talk, if you will, about Pete Rose.
Yeah. Well, you know, we go through the whole... I'll never forget, we're in spring training, and we're training in Plant City, Florida. And he tells me that he's been called to the other side of the state to meet with Peter Ubroth and Bart Giamatti. And he said, it's no big deal. He said, I got to go over there and meet him with them. There have been some gambling allegations, blah, blah, blah. I said, okay. So he comes back, and then the proverbial crap hits a fan. And I'll never forget, the Reds were playing a spring training game in St. Petersburg against the Mets at Old Al Lang Field. And I get a phone call from Jim Ferguson, who was the Reds media relations director at the time. He said, Pete's going to be late. He's going to be coming over in a car, not coming with a club. But just hang around. I was doing a pregame radio show. Mm-hmm. So now I get to Al Lang Field, and every media outlet of any importance in the world is there because the story's broken. I'll never forget, this is the essence of what this guy's all about. I'm in the third base dugout, which is visitor's dugout, all the media people, Sports Illustrated, all the New York papers, everybody. And here he comes down the left field foul line, because that's where he parked the car and walks down. He hits the dugout. These guys start to converge on him, and he holds up his hands. He turns to me. He said, I've got to do a radio show with him right now. We go in the clubhouse. Nobody's in there. And I said, Pete, you have to understand, I've got to ask you about this situation. You realize. He said, ask me anything you want to. I said, I'm not going to ask you every day, and I'm sure there's going to be things that are going to unfold as the season progresses, but we have to periodically talk about it. He said, not a problem. He was good. I marveled at the way he dealt with it. Obviously, he did not come clean, and I firmly believe until the day I die, when they laid all the evidence out for him, that meeting that he had with Uberoth and Giamatti, and he admitted to it, I believe he'd be in the Hall of Fame today. I truly believe that. I may be wrong. I may be naive. But, you know, he went forever and ever and ever and finally got a lot of money to write a book and admit it in the book that he had gambled on baseball.
After 15 years of denial.
Correct. And I think it would have made a major difference. I truly believe that. I don't know that he'll ever get in.
And I was going to ask you, do you think in our lifetime?
I think he's come to grips with that. I talk to him all the time. He met with the commissioner, you know, in December with Rob Manfred, and the commissioner made the announcement. And that night, my phone rings at 9:15 at home. And I've got his cell phone number, and I said, hello. He said, you still love me? I said, yeah, I do. He's a different guy today. The word love was not a part of his vocabulary back in the old days, and there's never a time when he and I don't talk on the phone or we see each other, he never fails to say I love you before he walks away. I think he's a better person today than he's ever been, because I think we all reach a point in our lives where we realize we're not immortal, and I think he's come to grips with that. I still love the guy. The two best friends I have in this game are Pete Rose and Joe Morgan. They're the two best friends I have in this game, and I love them like my blood courses through their veins and vice versa. But it is a human tragedy that transcends every single walk of life, what he did, because he truly felt like at times he was bigger than the game, and we all know that's not the case.
But it hurt you.
Kill me. I mean, it killed me. There was a time when a NBC station in Cincinnati came to call me and said, would you talk about Pete? They phrased it in such a way they wanted to trap me. And they said, talk about his gambling. And I said, I'll talk about his gambling on basketball and football. I said, I can't talk to you about his. And I never knew about it. And I think he bent over backwards to keep me from knowing about it. And so I went to the ballpark that day, and I ran into him, and I told him. He said, what the hell do you know about me gambling on baseball, football, basketball, and football? I said, Pete, time out here now. I said, let's understand one thing. We both know that I know about that, and you know that I know. And he's been a great friend to me. And as I say, he's changed for the better. I would be shocked if he ever makes it into the Hall of Fame in our lifetime.
Two quick things before you go. First of all, and you've probably heard this story. When Ernie Harwell, God bless him, was doing the Detroit Tigers, a guy pulls into a gas station in Michigan and wants to fill up his car, and the guy says to him, hurry up, it's 5 minutes to Ernie. That attachment between radio and the play-by-play broadcaster, you are the voice of the Cincinnati Reds for generations. Talk for a moment about that attachment.
Well, you know, it's funny because there have been so many things that have happened that you never think about. I mean, the years roll by, and the older you get, the faster it gets, and you don't think. You don't consciously say to yourself, I think there are guys that are egomaniacs in our business. You well know that our business breeds egomaniacs. And guys that are in the same position I am, and I'm not going to name them, but you know who I'm talking about, right, that think they're bigger than the game. And once you think that, then you've lost something. And I've never felt that way. But the years that Joe and I spent working together, it got to be, for want of a better term, such a phenomenon in that town that we would get mail addressed to us, Marty and Joe, Cincinnati, Ohio.
Wow.
And it would come through the downtown post office in Cincinnati.
Get delivered.
Oh, you kidding? Right to the ballpark. Simply, Marty and Joe, Cincinnati, Ohio. Wow. The first time that happened, and I had a guy that worked for the post office I came across, and we talked. He said, hey, we know where this is going. We don't need an address. We don't need 100 Riverfront Stadium. We know. And so that's the one time that it really made an impact on me. And the other time we would get mail beginning in middle of August from shut-ins, mm-hmm, from guys that drove over the road 16 and 18-wheel trucks.
From the blind.
Yes, yes. People like that. We were there. Umbilical cord to the outside world, and the sorrow that they could convey to us, that we know that there's only 3 weeks left in the season and we've got to wait through the wintertime for spring training, and that makes an impact on you. I mean, that really makes you feel like you're doing something that fulfills a need in the lives of a lot of people. And I've never forgotten that. I know John Miller and I had a conversation one night in San Francisco. He made a comment that when he was with the Boston Red Sox, that they were playing on the West Coast, and he made the comment, you know, if you're listening to the broadcast back in Boston, it was like 12:45 in the morning, drop us a line. This is way before,
right,
you know,
instant communication.
Yes,
yeah.
Social media.
Right.
And he said, it was unbelievable. We got, I don't know what he said, 250 or 300 responses. I said, you know what? That night, I did the same thing. We're playing in San Francisco. We got over 1,000 responses.
Wow.
And I know there are people that have formulas that can determine how many people were actually listening based on the amount of return.
Right.
I was blown away. We are in a wonderful, wonderful business. I've been involved in this business now, and I've never had anybody that tried to stab me in the back. I've worked for good people. I've trusted people. And I'm one of a handful of guys now, which is a thrill for me, that has done this job 40-plus years, and they've done it for only one team. That's important to me. Guys like Vinny and God rest his soul, Jack Buck, and Denny Matthews, and Bob Uecker, Jaime Harreen, and some of the other...
Herb Carneal.
Yeah, Herb Carneal worked for one team. And that's important to me. And I know that I'm on the downhill side now, and it won't be that many more years that I'll be doing this thing, but I know when I go to bed at night that I'm going to end up with the same team that I began with in 1974, and that's important to me.
A moment for you to talk about a father's pride in your son, who became a broadcaster and shares your booth, Tom.
Well, I, for one thing, I think that the greatest compliment a kid can pay his old man is to want to get into the same business he's in. Having said that, I also know that there are fathers who have put a lot of pressure on their kids to become a lawyer like them or a doctor like them or whatever they were. I never put any pressure on Tom or either of my two daughters to do anything. They do whatever they wanted to do because I would never allow one of them to come back and say to me, I did what you wanted me to do and I'm not happy doing it. He came home from Ohio University one summer and said, you know what? I think I want to do what you do for a living. And I said, that's great. There was a roast for me, cystic fibrosis in Cincinnati, and Bob Trumpy was a roaster, Skip Carey came in. It was really a nice affair before over 1,000 people. And Tom was in his senior year at Ohio University, and they asked him if he'd get up and talk about our relationship, and he said, I don't want to do that. And that was my first wife. My second wife, and she prevailed upon Tom to do it. And he was so good that the Channel 5 general manager came to me after the game and said, what's he going to do? And I said, he's looking for a job. He gave me his card. He said, give that to him and tell him to call me. He went to work as a weekend sports anchor. The next year, he was doing Reds games with Johnny Bench on television. And the next year, he was working with Harry Carey doing Cubs games in Chicago. I was blown away by it. And again, referencing Pete. Pete made the comment, as only Pete could do, he said he's got good bloodlines. All I did was to open the door, and his last name helped him. But once you get through that door, it doesn't make any difference whose old man you are. You either are good enough or you're not good enough. And he and I, we don't work together very much anymore, but the fact that he's there and I get to dine with him on the road and I get to see my grandkids play ball, and that's important to me. He's got his head screwed on right. He respects people. He never big leagues anybody. And I have people say to me, you know what, he's a better person than he is a broadcaster. And that's the greatest compliment anybody can pay to me and pay to him. And we've had a wonderful time since he came back from Arizona. And I give Bob Castellini, the owner of the Reds, a lot of credit, because he came to me one day shortly after buying the club and said, what do you think about bringing Tom back to Cincinnati? I said, I think it's a great idea, but it ain't going to happen. I said, he's firmly entrenched in Arizona. He married an Arizona girl. Mm-hmm. And Bob said, well, we'll see. And Bob made it happen, and I'll always be indebted to him for that. And I don't think Tom will ever go anywhere else. I mean, he's, you know, they give him the latitude to do NFL football for Fox and whatever else the Fox Network wants him to do. And so he's happy, and nobody loves Cincinnati, Ohio better than him. I never realized the love that he had for that town. And that's the only job that he would have ever left Arizona for, and that's to come back home. And thank God Bob Castellini made that happen.
What a joy to be with you. When the Reds win, you say on the air.
And this one belongs to the Reds.
And this one belongs to Ed Randall's Talking Baseball. That'll do it for us on MLB.com. If you're on the move, thanks for the ride, and thanks for listening to Ed Randall's Talking Baseball.